He used the express elevator from the garage and was in his brass and oak reception area 90 seconds later. Tony was behind the chest-high counter drinking coffee, looking tired.
Boat? Hobie asked him.
Tony nodded.
It's at the broker's. They'll wire the money. They want to replace the rail where that asshole damaged it with the cleaver. I told them okay, just deduct it from the proceeds.
Hobie nodded back.
What else?
Tony smiled at an apparent irony.
We got more money to move. The first interest payment just came in from the Stone account. $11,000, right on time. Conscientious little asshole, isn't he?
Hobie smiled back.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul. Only now Peter and Paul are the same damn guy. Wire it down to the islands at the start of business, okay?
Tony nodded and read a note.
Simon called from Hawaii again. They made the plane. Right now they're over the Grand Canyon somewhere.
Has Newman found it yet? Hobie asked. Tony shook his head.
Not yet. He's going to start looking this morning. Reacher pushed him into doing it. Sounds like a smart guy.
Not smart enough, Hobie said.
Hawaii's 5 hours behind, right? It'll be this afternoon. Call it he starts at 9, spends a couple hours looking. That's 4 o'clock our time. We'll be out of here.
Hobie smiled again.
I told you it would work out. Didn't I tell you it would work out? Didn't I tell you to relax and let me do the thinking?
Reacher woke up at 7 o'clock on his watch, which was still set to St. Louis time, as far as he could remember, which made it 3 o'clock in the morning back in Hawaii and 6 in Arizona or Colorado or wherever they were 7 miles above and already 8 in New York. He stretched in his seat and stood up and stepped over Jody's feet. She was curled in her chair, and a stewardess had covered her with a thin plaid blanket. She was fast asleep, breathing slow, her hair over her face. He stood in the aisle for a moment and watched her sleep. Then he went for a walk. He walked through business class and on into coach. The lights were dimmed, and it got more crowded the farther back he walked. The tiny seats were packed with people huddled under blankets. There was a smell of dirty clothes. He walked right down to the rear of the plane and looped around through the galley, past a quiet huddle of cabin staff leaning on the aluminum lockers. He walked back up the other side, through coach into business class. He paused there a second and scanned the passengers. There were men and women in suits, jackets discarded, ties pulled down. There were laptop computers open, briefcases stood on unoccupied seats, bulging with folders with plastic covers and comb bindings. Reading lights were focused on tray tables. Some of the people were still working, late in the night or early in the morning, depending on where you measured it from. He guessed these were middle-ranking people, a long way from the bottom, but nowhere near the top. In army terms, these were the majors and the colonels. They were the civilian equivalents of himself. He had finished a major and might be a colonel now if he'd stayed in uniform. He leaned on a bulkhead and looked at the backs of the bent heads and thought, Leon made me, and now he's changed me. Leon had boosted his career. He hadn't created it, but he had made it what it became. There was no doubt about that. Then the career ended, and the drifting began, and now the drifting was ended, too, because of Leon. Not just because of Jody, because of Leon's last will and testament. The old guy had bequeathed him the house, and the bequest had sat there like a time bomb, waiting to anchor him. Because the vague promise was enough to do it. Before, settling down had seemed theoretical. It was a distant country he knew he would never visit. The journey there was too long to manage. The fare was too high. The sheer difficulty of insinuating himself into an alien lifestyle was impossibly great. But Leon's bequest had kidnapped him. Leon had kidnapped him and dumped him right on the border of the distant country. Now his nose was pressed right up against the fence. He could see life waiting for him on the other side. Suddenly it seemed insane to turn back and hike the impossible distance in the other direction. That would turn drifting into a conscious choice, and conscious choice would turn drifting into something else completely. The whole point of drifting was happy, passive acceptance of no alternatives. Having alternatives ruined it, and Leon had handed him a massive alternative. It sat there, still and amiable above the rolling Hudson, waiting for him. Leon must have smiled as he sat and wrote out that provision. He must have grinned and thought, "Let's see how you get out of this one, Reacher." He stared at the laptops and the comb-bound folders and winced inside. How was he going to cross the border of the distant country without getting issued with all this stuff? The suits and the ties and the black plastic battery-driven devices, the lizard-skin cases, and the memorandums from the main office. He shuddered and found himself paralyzed against the bulkhead, panicking, not breathing, completely unable to move. He recalled a day not more than a year ago, stepping out of a truck at a crossroads near a town he had never heard of, in a state he had never been. He had waved the driver away and thrust his hands deep in his pockets and started walking, with a million miles behind him and a million miles ahead of him. The sun was shining and the dust was kicking up off his feet as he walked, and he had smiled with the joy of being alone with absolutely no idea where he was headed. But he also recalled a day 9 months after that, realizing he was running out of money, thinking hard. The cheapest motels still required some small amount of dollars. The cheapest diners, likewise. He had taken the job in the Keys, intending to work a couple of weeks. Then he had taken the evening job, too, and he was still working both of them when Costello came calling 3 whole months later. So the reality was that drifting was already over. He was already a working man. No point in denying it. Now it was just a question of where and how much and for who. He smiled. Like prostitution, he thought. No going back. He relaxed a little and pushed off the bulkhead and padded back through to first class. The guy with the striped shirt and the arms the same length as Victor Hobie's was awake and watching him. He nodded a greeting. Reacher nodded back and headed for the bathroom. Jody was awake when he got back to his seat. She was sitting up straight, combing her hair with her fingers. "Hi, Reacher," she said. "Hey, Jody," he said back. He bent and kissed her on the lips, stepped over her feet and sat down. "Feel okay?" he asked. She ducked her head in a figure eight to put her hair behind her shoulders. "Not bad. Not bad at all. Better than I thought I would. Where did you go?" "I took a walk," he said. "I went back to see how the other half lives." "No. You were thinking. I noticed that about you 15 years ago. You always go walking when you have something to think about." "I do," he said, surprised. "I didn't know that." "Of course you do," he said. "I noticed it. I used to watch every detail about you. I was in love with you, remember?" "What else do I do?" "You clench your left hand when you're angry or tense. You keep your right hand loose, probably from weapons training. When you're bored, you play music in your head. I could see it in your fingers, like you're playing along on a piano or something. The tip of your nose moves a little bit when you talk."
"It does?"
"Sure it does," she said. "What were you thinking about?" He shrugged. "Isn't that," he said. "The house, right?" she said. "It's bothering you, isn't it? And me. Me in the house, tying you down. Like that guy in the book, Gulliver. You know that book?" He smiled. "He's a guy gets captured by tiny little people when he's asleep. They peg him down flat with hundreds of tiny little ropes. You feel that way?" He paused a beat. "Not about you." But the pause had been a fraction of a second too long. She nodded. "It's different than being alone, right?" she said. "I know, I was married. Somebody else to take into account all the time. Somebody to worry about." He smiled. "I'll get used to it," she smiled back. "And there's the house, right?" He shrugged. "Feels weird." "Well, that's between you and Leon," she said. I want you to know I'm not putting demands on you either way, about anything. It's your life and your house. You should do exactly what you want. No pressure. He nodded, said nothing. So you going to look for Hobie? He shrugged again. Maybe, but it's a hell of a task. Bound to be angles, she said. Medical records and things? He must have a prosthesis. And if he's burned, too, there'll be records of that. And you wouldn't miss him in the street, would you? A one-armed man, all burned up? He nodded. Or I could just wait for him to find me. I could just hang out in Garrison until he sends his boys back. Then he turned to the window and stared out at his pale reflection against the darkness and realized, I'm just accepting he's alive. I'm just accepting I was wrong. He turned back to Jody. Will you give me the mobile? Can you manage without it today? In case Nash finds something and calls me, I want to hear right away if he does. She held his gaze for a long moment, and then she nodded, leaned down and unzipped her carry-on, took out the phone and handed it to him. Good luck, she said. He nodded and put the phone in his pocket. I never used to need luck, he said. Nash Newman did not wait until 9 o'clock in the morning to start the search. He was a meticulous man, attentive to tiny detail, as much in his ethics as in his professional specialty. This was an unofficial search, undertaken out of compassion for a troubled friend, so it couldn't be done on company time. A private matter had to be settled privately. So he got out of bed at 6, watching the faint red glow of tropical dawn starting beyond the mountains. He made coffee and dressed. By 6:30, he was in his office. He figured he would give it 2 hours, then he would have breakfast in the mess and start his proper work on time at 9. He rolled open a desk drawer and lifted out Victor Hobie's medical records. Leon Garber had assembled them after patient inquiries in doctors and dentists' office in Putnam County. He had bundled them into an old military police folder and secured it shut with an old canvas strap. The strap had been red, but age had faded it to dusty pink. There was a fiddly metal buckle. He undid the buckle, opened the folder. The top sheet was a release signed by both the Hobie parents in April. Underneath it was ancient history. He had scanned thousands of files similar to this one, and he could effortlessly place the boys they referred to in terms of their age, their geographic location, their parents' income, their ability at sports, all the numerous factors that affect a medical history. Age and location worked together. A new dental treatment might start out in California and sweep the country like a fashion, so the 13-year-old boy getting it in Des Moines had to have been born 5 years later than the 13-year-old boy getting it in Los Angeles. Their parents' income dictated whether they got it at all. The high school football stars had treatment for torn shoulders. The softball players had cracked wrists. The swimmers had chronic ear infections. Victor Truman Hobie had very little at all. Newman read between the lines and pictured a healthy boy, properly fed, conscientiously cared for by dutiful parents. His health had been good. There had been colds and flu and a bout of bronchitis at the age of 8. No accidents, no broken bones. Dental treatment had been very thorough. The boy had grown up through the era of aggressive dentistry. In Newman's experience, it was absolutely typical of any he had seen from the New York metropolitan area in the 50s and early 60s. Dentistry through that era consisted of a war on cavities. Cavities had to be hunted down. They were hunted with powerful x-rays, and when they were found, they were enlarged with the drill and filled with amalgam. The result was a lot of trips to the dentist's office, which no doubt had been miserable for the young Victor Hobie. But from Newman's point of view, the process had left him with a thick sheaf of films of the boy's mouth. They were good enough and clear enough and numerous enough to be potentially definitive. He stacked the films and carried them out into the corridor, unlocked the plane door in the cinder block wall, and walked past the aluminum caskets to the alcove at the far end. There was a computer terminal on a wide shelf out of sight around a corner. He booted it up and clicked on the search menu. The screen scrolled down and revealed a detailed questionnaire. Filling out the questionnaire was a matter of simple logic. He clicked on All Bones and entered No Childhood Breaks, Potential Adult Breaks. The kid didn't break his leg playing football at high school, but he might have broken it later in a training accident. Service medical records were sometimes lost. He spent a lot of time on the dental section of the questionnaire. He entered a full description of each tooth as last recorded. He marked the filled cavities, and against each good tooth he entered potential cavity. It was the only way to prevent mistakes. Simple logic. A good tooth can go bad later and need treatment, but a filled cavity can't ever disappear. He stared at the x-rays, and against spacing, he entered even, and against size, he entered even again. The rest of the questionnaire he left blank. Some diseases showed up in the skeleton, but not colds and flu and bronchitis. He reviewed his work, and at 7 o'clock exactly, he hit search. The hard disk whirred and chattered in the morning silence, and the software started its patient journey through the database.